I'm still very troubled with the 170 days it takes to test these kids. I mean, it's a haunting thought in my mind.
Lawmakers look at the backlog for analyzing rape kits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, proposed budget cuts won't stop advocates from fighting Alaska's high rates of sexual assault.
We are committed to this movement and to this cause, and I think we will figure it out.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska has the highest rate of sexual assault in the nation, but it has no mechanism for tracking untested rape kits. Now, legislators are considering an audit to find out just how big the backlog is. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
When the legislature's research department was asked to find out how many rape kits sat on shelves waiting to be analyzed, it kept on hearing one answer: unknown. The researcher could not even compare Alaska's kit processing rate to other states because there was so little hard data on how many kits had even been processed in the first place. In response, Senator Britta Gardner and Representative Garantar, both Anchorage Democrats, have each filed separate bills asking for an audit of rape kits in the state. TAR's aide, Ray Friedlander, laid out the problem in the House State Affairs Committee on Thursday, explaining the challenge of coordinating evidence processing rules with the many small police departments across Alaska.
There's not a single uniform protocol utilized by the 150 law enforcement agencies to do the same. So in essence, there could be a local law enforcement agency here in Alaska that is in possession of an untested sexual assault kit, potentially containing DNA that could remove rapists from Alaska's streets, but we don't know. There's no database or way to manage these untested sexual assault kits that have been shelved.
The bill would require every law enforcement agency in the state to go through their inventory and find out how many untested kits they have and when they were collected. Friedlander explained to Committee Chair Bob Lynn that the numbers have been high in places where this analysis has been done.
Texas had 20,000.
20,000.
20,000. Detroit had 11,000. Memphis had 12,164. Illinois had 4,000. And Ohio had 4,000. And we acknowledge that.
We don't know what we have here. May not have.
Right.
From what is known, there is a certain amount of variability in how different agencies handle rape kits. Local police departments set their own policies. The state troopers have only been required to send back all rape kits as of February of this year. Once kits make it to the state crime lab, there's a set protocol for tracking them. But even at the crime lab, there are problems in processing the kits. Orrin Dim is the forensic laboratory manager, and he explained that in emergencies, they can turn around kits in 24 hours. But usually, it takes much longer.
Our average turnaround time today is 170 days. Our oldest sexual assault request goes back 16 months today. I will say that is a vast improvement over the 6+ years it used to be.
That processing time troubled committee members like Anchorage Republican Liz Vasquez.
Why does it take so long?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, it takes so long because there are many times where the incoming number of requests for service exceed our capability to complete the analysis. We have more business than we can complete in a timely fashion.
Neither Vasquez nor Lynn found much comfort in that.
I'm still very troubled with the 170 days it takes to test these kids. I mean, it's a haunting thought in my mind.
The committee plans to hear the bill again next week. A separate request to audit the crime lab will be made later this month. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Governor Bill Walker led about 100 people in a Choose Respect rally and march through Juneau on today. The statewide initiative to raise awareness about Alaska's high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault started 6 years ago and grew in prominence after being embraced by former Governor Sean Parnell. Funding for prevention of such crimes has been cut in nearly in half in the proposed budget for next year, as the state faces a multi-billion dollar shortfall. Advocates say the cuts will slow down, but not stop their work. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Early in his speech at the rally, Governor Walker asked for a round of applause for the previous administration's efforts to raise the profile of Choose Respect. Between 2009 and last year, Governor Parnell and his team helped organize marches and rallies in nearly 200 communities statewide. Walker called what they did a great start.
Our administration also chooses respect, but we also choose action, and we have taken action. We have taken action in a number of ways. We're going to continue to take action to make sure that this doesn't continue on.
As an example, Walker cited his administration's hiring of a special investigator to look into allegations of sexual misconduct and other issues within the Alaska National Guard, which played a role in his campaign for governor against Parnell. He also touted his support for expanding Medicaid. Walker said Alaska takes great pride in being first in a lot of things, first in size, first in beauty, but he said being first in rates of domestic violence and sexual assault is not something to be proud of.
This is one day out of 365 days, and it's a great day from the standpoint that we are very aware of this, but we need to make sure the other 364 days are also just as much empowering people like yourselves to take action.
The governor also said this is not the time to cut funding for prevention, even as his own budget slashes $1.3 million from such programs. With a drop in oil prices leading to a state shortfall in the billions of dollars, Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Executive Director Lori Morton says the proposed cuts were not a surprise. She says they will slow but not stop the progress made so far.
It's too soon to stop trying to prevent these crimes.
There's still $1.5 million in the governor's budget for prevention, which the Alaska House of Representatives approved as well. Morton says that money will go to programs like Girls on the Run, Coaching Boys into Men, and Green Dot, designed to raise awareness about sexual assault and domestic violence. She says the cut might mean each of these programs get funds to launch efforts in one new community instead of three statewide. Morton says the council did a study on the fourth R, a program that teaches students about healthy relationships, and found it's having an impact on Alaska kids.
Less adherence to rape myths, you know, that she deserved it or she shouldn't dress that way, those kinds of things. There was less tolerance for physical aggression in relationships. So we have shown that that is effective here in Alaska.
Morton says she doesn't think the Walker administration is any less focused on ending domestic violence and sexual assault than the Parnell administration. She says, if anything, they're more dedicated to partnering with communities.
They're committed to eliminating these crimes. I think there's just a different way of looking at how to do that.
Back at the rally, Mandy O'Neill Cole with Juneau's Aware Shelter says organizations that receive money from the state for prevention efforts will just have to get creative in light of the state's fiscal problems.
It's our main goal to continue with the programming that we have. We are committed to this movement and to this cause, and I think we will figure it out.
She adds that it gives Alaskans an opportunity to step up and show how much progress has been made by supporting organizations trying to end domestic violence and sexual assault. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
A Senate subcommittee this afternoon cut all of the funding for domestic violence and sexual assault prevention programs statewide. The item will likely go to conference committee. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a profile of an Anchorage marijuana business that appears to be following the rules.
We're not selling marijuana, we're selling an experience. We want a safe place for people to come and consume their marijuana products.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Over half of all deaths from colon cancer could be prevented if everyone over 50 had regular colon cancer screenings. Stop this disease. Talk with your doctor about colon screening today. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
Marijuana is in legal limbo in Alaska. Multiple bills in the legislature will determine everything from permits to penalties. And in the meantime, municipalities are scrambling to find rules that protect the public, but also make room for an emerging industry. As KSKA Zachariah Hughes reports, a new marijuana club in Anchorage shows the tentative approach by businesses to navigate a shifting legal landscape.
Air purifiers whir inside the brand new private marijuana club in downtown Anchorage. The room is huge, with a stage at one end, lounge chairs in another, and very high ceilings. Teresa Collins shows off a gleaming bar decorated with mirrors and bright, colorful snack foods.
We got our food permit, and so we do have a munchies menu. Been doing like little sliders, nachos, different type of munchie items for our members. So
Collins is one of the co-owners of Potluck Events, a members-only private business hoping to capitalize on Alaska's expanding legal market for marijuana.
We're not selling marijuana, we're selling an experience. We want a safe place for people to come and consume their marijuana products. There is no place like this in Anchorage, and people have been asking for it.
And as far as anyone knows, the Potluck Club is doing everything legally. Customers buy a membership package ranging from $20 to $500. You can bring marijuana, provided it's under an ounce, but you can't buy or sell products because so far the state doesn't allow legal sales. Members aren't consuming in public because the club is private. And before even passing coat check, new members are ID'd and have to sign a waiver that outlines good conduct. Breaking it gets you kicked out. It's less like a bar to drop into than an events hall hosting parties, cannabis tastings, and assorted special occasions.
We've actually had interest for two weddings in here. We're definitely open to any type of event that somebody wants to have, and it doesn't have to be 420 friendly.
The space had its first event earlier in the month.
It was a soft open St. Patrick's Day.
All puns aside, marijuana is serious business, and Collins and her partners have invested a lot of money and time making sure they're on the right side of existing rules. And it wasn't easy. They struggled to find insurance, a space to rent, and are running everything by a lawyer for advice on compliance with city, state, and federal rules that are changing week to week. Jamie Hicks is another of Potluck Events' four owners and says on top of raising money and hiring a staff of 15, part of their business plan has been reaching out to neighbors and law enforcement so everyone knows what they're doing.
You can operate successfully in a professional way and still have the fun and still be able to be a benefit to society here. That was the first thing. Meet the neighbors, shake hands, find out what the community needs.
Even though the laws on marijuana are a bit murky right now, that doesn't mean new businesses can operate carte blanche. The Anchorage Police Department recently executed a search warrant on a high-profile business allegedly selling cannabis products, with more charges expected. Bruce Schulte is the spokesman for the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation and says Potluck Events is the kind of business that policy advocates have been hoping would appear after ballot measure 2 passed.
They are being good neighbors. They're being very upfront with APD and the fire marshal about what they're doing and how many people are going to be on site. So I think that that is helping the perception. They're doing everything they can to be model citizens, and I think that's hugely important right now.
With just a few weeks left in the legislative session, the assembly members in Anchorage see the prospect of comprehensive statewide legislation as unlikely, and that shifts the job of regulation to local governments, which is fine with officials here. The municipality has already gotten into the particulars of looking at permitting structures and public consumption rules. Todd Sherwood is with the city's legal department and says they're hoping for more municipal discretion in designing regulations.
Every municipality is a little different, but that's one thing I would say we generally agree on is we want the maximum amount of local control, but we just don't know what we can do until we have a complete package really from the state, and then we'll work with that.
Potluck Events is just one business getting out in front of the changing circumstances, but they aren't alone. Co-owner Hicks says they've been contacted by about 50 vendors and businesses about collaborating on events. For now, they feel like they've been lucky with how things have come together. They even found a building that is its own advertisement.
You know, when 420 West 3rd Avenue came up, and we couldn't really pass that up.
In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Board passed a budget last night that cuts about 60 full-time positions and trims many programs. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
In contrast to the hours of impassioned public testimony in the previous two school board meetings over the impact of budget cuts, the mood Wednesday was reserved, even resigned. Board President Heidi Haas says none of the board members was happy with the prospect of approving a budget that's more than $11 million lower than last year's due to state funding cuts driven by plummeting oil revenue.
I have a lot of heartburn around the cuts that we've made. These cuts are going to directly impact my three kids, as well as our other 14,000 kids.
Board Clerk Lisa Gentry says she's been increasingly bothered by the cuts in recent weeks, especially after hearing wrenching testimony Monday and Tuesday about how those cuts would diminish the quality of instruction.
After our Monday budget meeting, I did not feel good when I went home. I didn't feel like I was advocating for anybody. And especially after hearing all the testimony last night, it reinforced everything that I was thinking and everything that we could save.
Gentry says that's why she declared Wednesday that she can't support the budget. She says the testimony made her realize that even though the district claims the cuts won't lead to increased class sizes, they'll have much the same effect because cutting so much support staff like nurses and counselors will require teachers to assume those staffers' responsibilities.
That student that, you know, maybe causing a ruckus or having an emotional breakdown, teacher's going to have to take them out of the room and calm them down and give them one-on-one attention. So we may not have touched the classroom in real teacher's class size, but we've affected the classroom by cutting all these other programs.
Gentry says some of those cuts could be restored if the district would impose a salary freeze, which would save about $3.9 million. Gentry admits she proposed the freeze at the last minute. She says she's tried to raise the issue earlier and finally just had to bring it up before the board adopted the budget.
I want it on the record, so I came prepared tonight to say my piece.
Gentry considered making a motion to formally propose the salary freeze, but decided against it after Haas said it would take too much time to develop another budget that factored in the freeze and then reschedule more public hearings. Haas briefly recessed the meeting to confirm that with district and borough attorneys, who told her the budget schedule is dictated by state law and borough code. The board then adopted the $274.9 million budget 4-1, with Gentry dissenting. Vice President Wendy Dominique attended via telephone but wasn't allowed to vote. Member Sue Hull was absent. Gentry says she plans to formally propose the salary freeze in upcoming budget deliberations. Haas says testimony may also be given on other budget changes that may be proposed once district and borough officials learn how much the legislature has appropriated for education after it adjourns. This year's session is scheduled to end April 17th.
We'll do another work session and public hearing, and then there's always opportunity anytime a motion's on the table.
Haas says she believes the district may have to go through the same budget slashing exercise all over again next year. She says another cut of about the same size may be needed because of predictions the state will again reduce education funding due to the likelihood that oil prices will remain low through the coming year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Less than a week after losing a lawsuit in U.S. District Court, a coalition of conservation groups seeking to stop the Big Thorn timber sale has filed a notice of appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and asked for an injunction pending the outcome. Last Friday, U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein granted summary judgment in favor of the U.S. Forest Service and other defendants and rejected all of the arguments brought forward by environmental groups. Holly Harris is the coalition's attorney from Earth Justice, a legal team that represents environmental organizations. She says a timber sale the size of Big Thorn should go before a higher court.
When you're talking about cutting thousands of acres of old-growth forest that will take at minimum 150 or even 200 years to regain its old-growth characteristics, makes it important that the Ninth Circuit have an opportunity to review what the Forest Service has done.
The lawsuit was filed last summer by national and regional conservation organizations after the Forest Service made a final decision to move forward with the timber sale on Prince of Wales Island. The Big Thorn timber sale includes about 6,000 acres of old-growth forest, rainforest, which environmentalists say is critical habitat for deer and wolves. Last week, regional forester Beth Pendleton said it was critical to have some old-growth harvest to keep the remaining mills alive while the Forest Service transitions to a second-growth timber model. About two-thirds of the Big Thorn timber sale has been awarded to Viking Lumber in Klawock, which had hoped to start logging this spring. A kayak trip in Glacier Bay in 2006 inspired an engineer to research the impact of glacial runoff in the Gulf of Alaska. David Hill is an associate professor of civil engineering at Oregon State University. For the study, he used decades of state and USGS stream flow data combined with calculations on land characteristics and watershed size to create an analysis for the entire area. He found glacier melt makes up about 10% of the overall precipitation added to the Gulf. The annual amount is measured in multiple feet of water. Hill says he worked to model how quickly rain and snow melt started to flow.
And then once the water is mobile, we actually use equations that allow us to predict how long it takes to transport through the landscape out to the ocean. So there are two very different techniques, and they sort of tell, in some cases overlapping and in other cases complementary stories about what the overall hydrologic budget is for the Gulf of Alaska.
So what did your findings show? Give us some of what the results were over this period.
Well, so a couple of the key messages are, I would say that if you consider, again, we look just at the Gulf of Alaska drainage, so that portion of Alaska and Canada that flows out into the Gulf. And for that region, over a multi-decade period, we are finding that about 900 cubic kilometers per year of water runs off into the ocean. And to sort of give you a bit of a reference point, reference frame, that's about 50% more than the volume of water that actually flows out of, through the Mississippi River. So it's a very substantial amount of water coming from a relatively small area of land. Another thing that we looked at was whether or not there have been changes in the runoff over time. And this gets us to that period of 2003 to 2009 where our modeling study overlapped with satellite data of the area. And one thing that we can say with pretty good confidence is that about 60 cubic kilometers per year of water are running off into the Gulf of Alaska, which are derived from glacier loss, essentially. So we have the annual precipitation and snowfall that's running off, and about 8 to 10% of that total amount is coming from glacier loss.
What are the implications of so much fresh water mixing into the salt water of the Gulf of Alaska?
That's a great question. That freshwater influx does several important things. Number one, it helps to control what we refer to as water column properties, so the temperature and the salinity and the vertical structure in the water column of those quantities. And that's certainly related to ecology, related to fisheries resources. And so the ability to sort of predict where things are going to be more or less salty, where things are going to be warmer and colder due to variable freshwater inflow. That's very interesting to fishery biologists. The other thing that it does is these freshwater inflows play a very strong role in controlling surface currents. So for example, if there was a contaminant spill, the ultimate fate of that spilled substance being transported by surface currents is being strongly influenced by the freshwater inflow into the nearshore waters. And then finally, if you take a broader perspective, this significant freshwater inflow into the Gulf of Alaska is a very important driver of the Alaska coastal current. So this strong current that flows from southeast to northwest up along the coast is being in strong part driven by this freshwater runoff.
Were these findings what you expected, or was it surprising?
There are two things that we are sort of most pleased with about this study. On the one hand, this is really the first study where we are able to, with significant precision, both in time and in space, explain where water is flowing into the Gulf of Alaska. What I mean by that is that, you know, we don't just have one number that is kind of averaged over the entire drainage area. We have a very, very fine spatial resolution. So we can tell you how much water is flowing into every little bay and every little fjord and every small creek coming out into the Gulf. The other thing that we're really happy with this study is that really for the first time in Alaska, we are able to take a modeling study and take these satellite data and show that they actually agree very well. And that's really quite exciting, because what that means is that in the future, the ability to use remotely sent satellite data to kind of monitor the water resources and the hydrologic budget for Alaska is going to be only get better and better. So it's a very exciting technology.
David Hill is a professor of civil engineering at Oregon State. Links to his Gulf of Alaska research are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The American Lung Association of Alaska invites you to join their premier annual cycling event, the Clean Air Challenge, on May 9th. This family-friendly one-day event begins in Talkeetna and offers routes ranging from 10 to 100 miles. This fundraiser benefits the American Lung Association to support lung health programs across Alaska. For more information, visit cleanairchallengeak.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.